Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly from Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because, well, I wanted a place online for boaters to swap information and recommendations. And now that it's up and running, I've been getting out to meet my members. And you can hear me regularly on boat radio chatting to people from all areas of the marine leisure industry. Well, at some point during the past few weeks, my producer hatched a plan to get me out onto the water. Actually, not just onto the water, but under it. So now, I'm in the middle of preparations for what will be the world's first live shark dive radio show. I'll be under 30 meters of water, 3 miles off the coast of Florida, in the company of renowned shark diver, conservationist, and filmmaker Jim Abernathy. You'll be able to listen live from anywhere in the world by switching on boat radio. You'll be able to watch, too, because we'll be fitted with cameras. It's going to be sensational. Of course, all of this requires special equipment. And that's where my next guest comes in. John Hopp works for Ocean Technology Systems, the world leader in underwater communications gear. So I met him a couple of weeks ago, and I began by asking him to show me the amazing mask I'll be wearing when I come face to face with the most feared predators in the ocean.
The mask has been out since 2009. 2008, we introduced it. 2009, we actually started delivery of it. We've kind of taken over the world for underwater communications, a lot with the media. If you watch Shark Week, our mask is really, it's a huge commercial for us. We have one cameraman who doesn't work for us, but he uses our equipment a lot. His name is Andy Casagrande. His full name is Andy Randy Casagrande IV. ABC4 is his production company, and he has been shooting really sharks. He does a lot of big animal stuff, not just sharks, both terrestrial and in the water as well. And he uses our equipment for that, to be able to communicate underwater. Basically, you know, to talk about the interaction they're having with the animals. And again, for Shark Week, it's big sharks.
So let's actually talk about that. The mask itself is a full face mask.
Right.
You have one here that you're going to show. And the amazing thing is that you can actually talk underwater. So now you can breathe underwater, survive underwater, and talk underwater.
Right. Exactly. I don't have a regulator in this. There's a second stage regulator that goes to it. Now, my understanding is you're going to be doing a shark dive.
So they say.
I plan on doing the shark dive,
but, you know, life happens sometimes.
It's really a bucket list thing. It should be anyway.
Yeah. It wasn't on my bucket until a couple of weeks ago, but okay.
Well, you're going out with Jim Abernathy. Jim's a good friend of the company. I've known Jim for quite a while, and I've been out on his boat. We did a little board to Tagger Beach over in the Bahamas. Absolutely probably one of the best dives I've ever been on, bed dive trips. And I've been lucky to travel kind of around the world a little bit. I've done a lot of Australia. I've done some Southeast Asia, all around the Caribbean and the West Coast, East Coast of the United States, and even some lakes in Lithuania and the Black Sea.
So first off,
that area of the Caribbean or of the Bahamas was really pristine. I mean, the reef was as healthy as any reef I've seen, I'd have to say anywhere. And then the numbers of sharks were just absolutely phenomenal. The lemon sharks, Caribbean reef sharks, and then the tagger sharks, which finally came in. We were a little worried. They didn't come in for the first couple of days. But the lemons and the Caribbean reef sharks were in such numbers that they were literally bumping into you, and you didn't bother to turn around and look. And it's kind of hard because I remember as a young man, and I've been diving for 41 years now, but I remember as a young man and coming to Jensen Beach, Stewart area, Hutchison Island, and we were diving off there and I saw my first shark. And it was a nurse shark, and it was a pretty big nurse shark. Of course, it was probably only about 6 feet, and I'm sure I thought it was 9 feet. But it really excited me. I mean, shark, 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 shark. You know, we're yelling at each other. We didn't have comms at that point, obviously, in 1979. But the so that to go from there, where I saw my first nurse shark and was so excited about it, to be in the water with literally dozens of Caribbean reef sharks and lemon sharks, to the point as to where they're coming up and bumping into you, and you don't even bother to turn and look.
So there was no fear involved.
No,
you felt completely comfortable.
They're not there to eat you.
So how did you know that? How did you instinctively, you could just sense it, that you were not in any danger?
Well, you know, the first dive or so. But I've dived around sharks a good bit now in my later life. I'm talking about my earlier experience with a nurse shark. And I've dived with sharks in Australia. Probably one of my earlier experiences was in Australia off of Lady Elliot Island. There was a place there called Shark Hole, and that's where the bronze whalers and other sharks had come in. And literally, you go outside on a rock, and they're swimming as close as you are to me. And that was my first experience where you actually realize that they're not there to consume you.
Mm-hmm.
They come into that area because when the tide comes up, the octopus come out. And they're there to eat, I'm assuming, because of the numbers of octopuses.
The octopus is there.
Yeah, the octopus come out, and that was their prey. Well, their prey is going to be tailored sort of specifically to whatever the region is.
Right.
And the octopus come out of the reef there, and they're kind of cruising the shallows. And I'm assuming they're hunting for the octopus, based from the numbers that I saw. I didn't talk to anybody and ask anybody. It was just an assumption that I made at the time. And they like octopus, you know, just like we do when we go to the sushi restaurant.
What was so special about the dive with Jim then? So
yeah, so you fast forward from then, that was back in the 1990s, and you fast forward then to you know, Osprey Reef when we went diving. We've been diving off of there, and then quite a bit of others, and then I lived down here in Marathon, and we had nurse sharks that we did a nurse shark dive up. I've got that on my YouTube channel if you want to take a look at it. We had pet nurse sharks, literally, that would just line up and for you to pet them. Now, of course, we had bait back then as well, just before they made it illegal to feed in Florida waters. And but they were tame. I mean, it was just like your neighborhood dog that would come up, and if you stop feeding them or stop petting them in particular, they would come up and bump you, and then you'd start petting them again, and they would settle right down and settle into the sand and relax. So you get the impression as to, you know, what's a threat and what's not. Again, sort of like the neighborhood dog. If the neighborhood dog comes up and bares his teeth, you know, you probably have a problem. But if the neighborhood dog, not that they come up and wipe your tail, which they do, but that, we call that swimming. And but they come up, and you can tell if they're interested in you or not. You can tell if they're aggressive, their posture, and so forth. And these sharks that are down there are just so many of them. And they really weren't interested in eating people. So they're beautiful, beautiful animals. And, you know, it gets into the shark conservation side and the shark finning. You know, I'm a hunter and a fisherman, and I harvest, I eat what I take, but the shark finning is just devastating to the shark population. It's just really, it's really terrible what's happening. And unfortunately, some cultures really promote that. No, the thing's turning around, I think, a little bit to a certain extent in a lot of the cultures, specific cultures that eat shark fins and eat shark fin soup and so forth. So what you're doing is you're doing your shark dive, and you're going to be able to talk. And I believe you're going to broadcast live from underwater. Is that
correct? That's the plan. Yeah. That's the plan.
Well, so what we do is from Ocean Technology Systems.
So, of course, my producer is hoping something happens to me. I'm kidding.
Well, that... Yeah, I guess it would. That's where the viral videos come from.
That's where it is.
You know,
yes.
You know,
I'm kidding.
Right.
Yeah. So this mask, which is totally amazing.
Yeah.
How did you end up falling into finding these? Because two guys came up with this, right?
The company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jerry Peck and Mike Pelissier started the company. Mm-hmm. They incorporated in 1984, basically as a garage business. And it was just the two of them. They did everything from the manufacturing process. And Mike was a salesman, but he also came in and he drilled holes. He soldered boards. He did everything as well. And Jerry designed the stuff. And Jerry's sort of the mad scientist of the group, probably a little more mad than scientist, but he's a good guy. And he would design it, and they would both assemble it, and then Mike would go out and sell it. And we got some equipment Navy approved, and the company really started promoting to public safety. A lot of the search and rescue teams use our equipment. Carry about 95% of the market share for underwater communications for public safety.
I was actually talking to a lady. She's a chief in the fire department, and her area is not ocean rescue, but she does canal rescue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Are you guys the only ones that make these masks?
There's a couple of full face masks out there, Interspiro, ours, and a couple other brands.
Okay.
We represent Interspiro's.
Mm-hmm.
Who I guess
I don't know.
You can tell me your name later on, and
yeah.
I'll tell you if I may know her or not.
But they were very happy with them, especially one of the reasons being pesticides. Now they don't have to take in the pesticides in all the canals.
Right. And that sort of segues into another region, why we use full face masks.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that. I can go through the list of that.
Yeah.
But the history of the company, with that, they started it. Just the two of them, and we have close to 60 employees now, 50, it varies a little bit, but we're between 55 and 60 employees right now. And we occupy an 18,000 square foot building, and we've actually outgrown it. We're really pinching for space. We're trying to figure out how to do things in our limited area. We may expand into another building or what. We're not sure, but so it is. It's sort of the typical American success story to go from a garage
mm-hmm.
business, two guys, to a small company. I mean, we're still small, between 50 and 60 employees.
Now, are they divers? How did they divide?
They are. They are. Mike came with a Navy background, a Navy diving background. He spent some time over in Vietnam, and then Jerry was sort of a mad scientist developer, and he got interested in diving back in the 60s, and he started tinkering and building stuff, and he worked for a couple of different companies, and then finally branched out. He and Mike branched out on their own and started Ocean Technology Systems. And so they're both divers. They both, when we go out and we shoot video, they generally both have Moldy with us, and Jerry still designs. Mike's kind of retiring a little bit. He should. He's enjoying life now, about to be a granddad.
Mm.
And he's having a pretty good time with things. And,
so something came across semi-time. That they just said, you know what, we need more than the O signal and I'm out of air. We want to be able to actually communicate.
Right. And the military really was a driving force, along with public safety. The sport market has been a really tough nut to crack. People have, they have their standard equipment, and it's changed. It's different. It is something that's, it is advanced equipment. It is something you need to learn how to use. A lot of people find, and this is what we really found after the advent of the Guardian mask, we found that a lot of people, when they start to dive at the experience of the folks that we're working here with on this television show, Pirates and Privateers is the television show. They're shooting a pilot right now for it.
What's that pilot about?
Treasure hunting. All around the Caribbean, around Florida and the Caribbean, the Bahamas, and all down through the Caribbean.
Oh, so you're going to come in a huge need for that then?
Well, that's the sort of integrated into the show. When they're diving, they want to be able to interact and talk, and
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a big part. We integrate our communications into the video, and that really changes things. You think of underwater video as silent movies, and we've taken underwater video out of the silent era. It's no longer Al Jolson, and the jazz man. Most video, when you think of underwater video, is hiss, hiss, glove, glove, or pretty music. And or voiceover, you hear the narrator in the documentaries talking about the stuff, whatever they're talking about, octopus or like we were talking about earlier, or shrimp, mantis shrimp. I saw a recent documentary on, and a lot of it's voiceover. And now they can actually give their verbal interchange while they're looking at something actually underwater, and it really has changed underwater video in a lot of ways. We won an Emmy Award for it, the big Emmy. A national Emmy for a show called Expedition Earth with Stan Waterman. Stan Waterman is really the father of underwater video. Not the father, but he's a big mainstay of early underwater video. Was it Jacqueline Bisset, the movie The Deep?
Jacqueline Bisset.
And Jacqueline Bisset.
Uh-huh.
He shot that. And then and also Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws. They were the stars of Expedition Earth. Where they were diving down Cocos Islands.
So they were using your equipment for that?
They were using Interspiro masks at the time because this wasn't developed. The Guardian
mm-hmm.
wasn't out then. So they were using Interspiro masks, and my boss went along and shot was one of the underwater shooters and also the recorder of the underwater audio. We've won a few other awards. Most recently was for an episode of 60 Minutes on the coral reefs of Cuba. It's called The Gardens of the Queen, and it was with Anderson Cooper in a segment of 60 Minutes. And we won an Edward R. Murrow Award for that. The program won the Edward R. Murrow Award. And of course,
we're attached to that program.
Exactly.
So
and
there
we're
you
a
go.
Piece of it. So,
and
so,
how did you get into that world?
Me personally, or the
just the company in general?
That's mostly word of mouth and just experience. You get underwater shooters that, videographers that are familiar with the equipment,
mm-hmm.
and then the more work they get, the more work we get. That was a, I went along with a guy named Bill Mills out of Tampa, St. Pete, and he has a company called Underwater Film and Video. So if you need any underwater shooting done, he can do it. We have a network of underwater shooters, Becky Kagan Schott, her and her husband David are up-and-comers in the shooting world. Joe Berg, who's working on this television show, he's learning our equipment, so he'll be part of our network here in the future as well. But we have a network of shooters, Andy Cansagrande, that I was talking about earlier. All the work that he gets when it's underwater, we get to tag along. So it's really nice from that standpoint. So it's... it's really kind of word of mouth. We don't do a lot of advertising. We don't have commercials. We don't only a couple of print ads we've done in the past. I think we only have one print ad running right now in Dive Training Magazine. And other than that, we don't do any advertising.
And what about the regular diver? Are these in the dive shops now?
We have quite a few dive shops. We have a network of them around the country. Miami, we have some dive shops in Miami and Points North. The Florida Keys, we were just talking about that. It's a little bit of a dead zone, which is kind of unusual, but they tailor to a little different clientele here. This is a travel destination. You have a lot of local divers as well, but most are people that come in from other destinations to dive here. And so we don't have a strong representation here in Florida Keys. Hopefully we'll change that here. Eventually, I'm hoping to change that pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But all up and down the east coast of Florida, we have several dealers over in the Tampa area and then up in the Panhandle as well.
And as time goes on, will they become more affordable for the everyday person?
They do. The Guardian, as an example, started out in the 800 and 859, I think it was, and it's now down to 749, I think, is our current retail.
So
I don't do much in sales. Totally. I do mostly training. Well, that's part of the business model,
right?
Mm-hmm. I go around and I train mostly technicians on how to maintain the equipment, both the Interspiro mask, the Divator Mark II, commonly referred to as the Yaga mask, and then the Guardian now, and then we have a new mask coming out that's called the Stealth. Actually, it's been out for a little while. We have about 500 or so now in the market that have sold, and I'll be teaching the technician course for it as well.
So when you say the technicians, you're basically training the cameraman around the country and how to do it?
Well, the technicians are the maintenance. So if you have a piece of equipment, if you have a regulator, it needs to be overhauled at least once a year, or sometimes depends on the factory recommended once or twice a year. And then, 250 dives or whatever the case may be, that they need to be completely overhauled. Because it is life support, so it's very important that the equipment be maintained well.
Mm-hmm.
It's that whole breathing thing underwater.
Mm-hmm.
So you want your gear to work. You want it to be, you want it to be very reliable, because again, if it fails, you have serious issues underwater. And so I teach the technicians how to maintain it. Now, another thing I do is I travel around, like in this case with Pirates and Privateers, I'm teaching them how to use the equipment. Well, it's not a certification course, it's a familiarization. But I came in to show them how to use the full face mask and then also how to integrate the audio into their video cameras so that they get the two disciplines.
Yeah.
Well, when you're shooting a production, you have two things primarily, and that's going to be your video, and then also you have your audio. So
mm-hmm.
you have your cameraman, you have your sound guy,
mm-hmm.
and those are the ones that are going to give you the content that is written by their producers and the writers and presented by the producers, but that is put out, and then you have your final product, and that's a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal is that the divers, when they go in the water, that they sound the best they can, and that it really becomes second nature. They shouldn't have to focus so much on getting the audio. It should be, the audio should come with the video and on the subject matter that they're shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the audio just should be, it's just as natural and embedded as we can get it, where it, it's just like, you know, again, when you shoot video, you have your sound guy over, you know, and he, if you're shooting a television show or a newscast, whatever the case may be, you have your sound guy with a boom, and he's got the dead bunny up above you, and that's his job, is to make everything sound good. And so we're trying to integrate that to where the underwater video works the same way as the with audio as a terrestrial or topside production.
So how did you end up with the, in this company? Was it just like a, you met them at a bar some night and started chatting, or it wasn't quite as romantic as that?
Well, I was kind of recruited for the job. My background's military and law enforcement.
Okay.
And
a lot of them use this, right?
Right, but actually, well, in the military and law enforcement, I did minimal diving in law enforcement. But I did a couple of things where I lived. We were very rural, and we didn't have too many drownings. And when they did have drowning, it was a matter of just grabbing them and pulling them out of the water because they're usually right there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any really – well, we did have deep lakes, but not too many drownings, only a couple. And then river drownings, which we worked a few of those while I was in. But I've been diving since 1975 and avidly for most of that time. All the boys in the family dive. My sister now, she took it up at the age of 50. I would say that was like last year, but that's not quite the case. She's been diving now for a little while. I won't say where her age is.
No, I was just going to say, you're going to dangerous territory there.
Yeah, well, actually, she's pretty humble about it. She's one of the hardest working people I've ever met. She's a dairy farmer. Wouldn't do that for anything.
And, so you're the diver. She's a dairy farmer. And you have another sibling, right?
I have a twin brother, and I have an older brother. And they're in aviation. We own a helicopter business up in Panhandle, Florida,
okay.
Up in Panama City. But the boss...
The adventure is not part of your life at all.
Oh, but the boss was looking for... He lost two employees. They were brothers, as a matter of fact, and they were they both actually left the company and went into law enforcement. And I came from law enforcement, and he was looking for somebody that was an avid diver with a background in military and law enforcement. And we have a mutual friend, actually, Tracy Robinette. And Tracy said that when the boss told him he was looking for somebody to replace Jim and his brother... And Tracy said, I think I know that guy. And I was working a contract with Tracy overseas. And when we were prepping for our contract in Southeast Asia, it was there in Southern California. And I stopped in and met the boss and basically was interviewed over a cup of coffee. And
connection.
And they offered me a job. So, yeah, I mean, I moved from Marathon, Florida to Southern California, and
not a bad move.
Okay.
I'm not.
It's too crowded for me.
Not your thing.
No, it's too crowded. It's too many people. It's just way too crowded. The diving is excellent out there, actually. Catalina Island is probably some of the prettiest diving. And the kelp diving, when the kelp is there, the kelp has been denuded by El Nino came in and cleaned out the kelp. They killed off all the kelp. The warm waters did. There's some limited patches. Hopefully, I haven't been out diving. I hate to say this. I haven't been diving out there in the kelp for a while. And hopefully the kelp will come back because it is absolutely gorgeous. If you ever get a chance to go dive the kelp out in California, it's remarkable. Yeah, absolutely beautiful stuff. It's like a walk through the rainforest, whereas the coral reef is sort of a stroll through a garden, you know, a flower garden. The kelp is really kind of a walk through the rainforest.
So there's all creatures in amongst it.
Right. And it's different. It's a totally different environment. It's a little colder, so you have to dress a little more, I wouldn't say technical. The diving is a little more difficult from the standpoint that you're more restricted with your thermal protection, your exposure suits, be it a wetsuit or dry suit, whatever you happen to be wearing. So, you know, I'm lucky that I get to dive occasionally, not as much as we'd like to. If you want to dive, don't take up working in the dive industry.
You're the second person that's told me.
Is that right?
Yeah. The dive industry.
Yeah, especially for the manufacturers. It was a little different when I lived here in the Keys. I was a dive master, and I got to dive a lot. But that's different. You know, that's a different field, really, when you're working for a retail, you know, destination dive site and a retail outlet, which is a diving site down at Marathon, closed in 2002. But it's working for the manufacturer, you spend a lot of time manufacturing. Now, I don't build things, but there's a lot more to it than that. And, you know, I travel a lot to train and dive little. When we do demos, as an example, I just don't get in the water because you lose control of the demo. So I kit people up and put them in the water. Now, this is a little different what we've been doing here. because I'm getting in the water and helping them record their audio, helping them with it. They're doing it, although I did a little bit. We've come up with a way to record to a GoPro camera, which is really pretty cool.
That's so cool.
And very simple.
So we're down here in the Keys, and you're working on training these people who are doing a reality show on treasure hunting, is that what it was?
Yes.
And so you're teaching them how to, if they're in the middle of nowhere and they don't have you at their side, something breaks, they know how to put it back together again.
That's part of what I'm doing here. I'm teaching, I'll be teaching one of the, one of the talents, but he'll be with them all the time. How to maintain the regulator. So if they're out on an expedition, say they're down in Cuba, they're headed to Cuba, they're doing some other locations over in the Bahamas, and then down, I think they're headed down to Belize as well, maybe to the DR, I don't recall. But if they're out a ways away and they don't have a dive shop to drop into, or they don't have a technician at a local dive shop, which there's only a few here in Florida that know how to maintain our equipment, they can basically fix any or troubleshoot the regulator itself, the second stage regulator that goes into the mast that you breathe off of. So I'm teaching them that, and then again we went through showing them how to record to their camera. So they're laying natural soundtrack to the video as they're recording it, and so they're they have audio directly laid onto the video, and it just simplifies things. And hopefully a lot of the shows that we work with, occasionally you'll hear them dub it. I think that's just one of those things that we notice it. Other people probably wouldn't pay any attention to it whatsoever. But it kind of...
it's actually probably quite easy to dub because you can't see the mask movement.
Well, that's one of the advantages of the mask. And a lot with Hollywood, they want to be able to see the entire face of the talent in the water. And there are some ways to do it. They're not very good. They do have issues, and that without an oral nasal pocket, you have CO2 issues build up as you're diving. You have to flush the mask out. There's one mask we make comps for. It's a Japanese-made mask called the Diveways, and it's not popular amongst the divers. It's a difficult mask to use, just because it's so big. Big, and it's got this big airspace, if you can imagine. And
so they can see the whole face.
So they can see. The regulator sits right here, and they can pretty much see the whole face. And it's it just presents problems. They have to flush the mask out. Actually, the valve's on this side, but they have to open up a valve and blow air through it to flush in the CO2 out. Otherwise, the divers will start to get headaches for just hypercapnia. It's CO2 accumulation that you don't effectively wash it out. It'll give you a headache and has other bad effects if it gets even worse.
Are you guys working on kind of changing the style of that full face mask?
Well, that one, there's no changing that one. We try to put them into the Guardian, which has an integrated oral nasal pocket. Mm-hmm. And the way the Guardian works, and again, I don't have a regulator here, but the regulator goes in place and it injects all the air through a vent underneath each eye. That circulates the air across the visor. It defogs it too, so there's no fogging of the mask. And then you inhale down through the check valves on each side of the oral nasal pocket, and then when you exhale out through the regulator. So what you have is a one-way flow of gas through the mask, and air, through the mask, and that just helps keeping the carbon dioxide flushed out. So you have fresh air coming in this way, and you're exhaling out that way, so you have low CO2 accumulation. So the mask is really effective for almost any diving that you need to do, from sport to public safety to light commercial work. And now
so who are the most users of this mask?
Right now we've got... And this is a guess. If we have between probably 13 to 15,000 masks out there on the market, the primary customers, we have public safety is probably our biggest niche with the Guardian. We hope to approach the military at some point with a new version of the Guardian. It's actually called the Stealth. It's a different regulator, same mask, mm-hmm. except it's black. But it's the same mask. You can actually snap the other regulator in this. The regulator is what's different on the mask, high performance. Mm-hmm. It's a higher performance regulator. And but public safety, aquariums, if you go to aquariums, Epcot Center. Epcot Center uses our equipment. The Atlanta Aquarium uses our equipment. Long Beach Aquarium, the Seattle Aquarium, New England Aquarium, I could go on and on.
Now, with this reality show, will they, do you guys sponsor them, or how does that work?
It's sort of a split. We provide some of the equipment. It's on consignment, so we'll get the equipment back when they're done.
Okay.
They're looking at buying additional gear. We'll supply so much, and then they determine if they need more than over and above what we supply them, then they're talking about purchasing it. Because I have to say, it's been a very successful trip. Some of the people that got in the water, I think they were a little hesitant, you know, as to what their experience was going to be. They had experience with another brand of mask, and I won't mention who, but they had an experience with another brand of mask, and it was a bad experience. And unfortunately, it sort of taints the entire, category of equipment, the full face masks. It didn't taint ours, but in general it does. I refer to it as poisoning the water. If you buy a piece of equipment and it's an inferior piece of gear, then you'll put it on the shelf, and all full face masks are bad. Or that communication sucks, you know, it doesn't work. Often, though, you know, it's all the application. You have to learn how to use the equipment. If you don't know how to use it, then you're probably going to have a bad experience, and that's going to reflect poorly on the equipment. That's one reason why I'm here as well. But they had a bad experience with the other equipment. It didn't work well. It was wet, and there was other complaints. And one of the individuals that's in the show is Kane Fisher. If you know Mel Fisher, today's the day. The Mel Fisher Museum, the treasure hunting museum down in Key West.
Found, we talked about that earlier.
They're the ones that found
how bad I am with names?
Yeah, there you go. They're the ones that found the Atosha, the wreck of the Atosha, one of the richest shipwrecks in U.S. waters ever found. Mm-hmm. And Mel was quite a character. He passed away quite a few years ago. And his son, Kane, actually was instrumental in the discovery of almost everything. Kane was very experienced with it, and he's going to be on the show. And he's tall. He's 6'6". And I was a little concerned when I saw him. It's like, you know, we have one size fits most people. And fortunately, he got in the water, and we went diving over at Jules Undersea, Jules Lodge. Just as a training place, it's really nice. As a training place, it's very controlled. You just walk in the water, and you can get done what you need to do as far as from a training standpoint. And he came out of the water. He was just ecstatic. He loved it. And everybody else that dived this year, all the talent that dived it, the camera people that dived it, came out with nothing but positives to say. Oh, so it was really, it was a boost to the ego. It was nice. Mm-hmm. Every now and again you do a demo and things don't work out so well, and it kind of knocks you down a notch. But
when you're dealing with experienced divers, I'm sure they can appreciate it.
Yeah. It makes a difference. It really does make a difference. And you have to be open-minded. It is one of those things where if you don't want to use it, I can't make it like that. But if you're open-minded and you learn how to use the equipment, and you want to learn how to use the equipment, it can really change the way you do things. As experienced divers, we all know about, you know, trying to get somebody's attention underwater. If it's darker out, you know, you're using flashlights, you're flashing your light, or you take your knife out and you bang your tank trying to get somebody's attention. If they're not looking your direction, you have to get their attention somehow. Now it's a simple matter. Where'd you go?
Yeah.
Push the button. Where did you go? Hey, I'm getting really cold. Let's go back to the boat. How much air do you have? All those little things. Now, of course, we're mini season right now is going on. So it's, hey, there's a lobster over here. It has a back door. You know, and
mini season being, explain what mini season is.
Well, mini lobster season. They have an early season that's 2 days long for the sport divers to be able to get into the water before the general season opens up. So it gives the sport divers a chance to get in the water before all the commercial lobster pots get in the water. So
it's quite a big deal down here.
It's crazy. I mean, when I lived down here during lobster season, during mini season, we didn't even think about getting in the water because there's too many crazies out there. My understanding is there's been one fatality so far this year. There may have been more. I haven't seen the news. That was just from yesterday. There was one fatality. I think down the Middle Keys somebody died. But that's common. And the same thing in California when all lobster season opens up out there. We'll generally have a fatality or two or three. And, you know, people who come down to go diving and enjoy the sport maybe haven't been in the best of shape, or they haven't kept their skill levels up.
That's me. I'm in good shape, but I haven't been keeping my skills up, so that's what's keeping me a little bit wary of doing the whole thing.
You know, to think of what you're doing is a crawl, walk, run. So tomorrow you're going to get, I'm understanding you're getting in the water to do a refresher course. Mm-hmm. If you can, get a couple of dives in. Check with Jim. They have boats going out all the time. They're at Jim Abernathy Scuba Adventures. And they have boats going out all the time. It's a nice operation. They'll take you out to some easy stuff, and then you get into a little deeper.
He did say that. He said he'd take me out to see some turtles and dolphins.
Oh, there you go.
Shut up. You're going out to see turtles and dolphins, you'll be fine.
And you just pay attention to what they say. Take it easy. Don't do anything difficult.
For some reason, actually, I mean, of course, anybody should be a little bit nervous about doing something that they haven't done in 20 years. But I'm not. I am to a certain point, but not to the extent that I would expect myself to be.
Right.
Maybe because I've been around people like you and Jim, who are very professional and know exactly what's going on, it makes me feel like it's going to be okay.
Yeah, you'll be fine. It is just a matter of, learning your equipment. And you have to learn to trust your equipment. As far as when they put you in the full face mask. Exactly. When they put you in the full face mask, if you can, get in a pool first. It's a crawl, walk, run methodology. Yeah. So you just take it easy. The last thing you want to be when you're out doing the shark dive is focused on the mask, learning how to dive the mask. Because that should be second nature at that point. You want to be focused on looking for sharks. And depending on where they take you, if they take you to where I think they're going to go, if there's a wreck offshore.
There was a choice of 90 feet or 280, I believe.
280?
I think he said something about that. And then he saw the look on my face and he went quickly back to it. But we'll do the 90.
You don't want to do the 280.
No.
I understand what the 280 feet is, a blue water dive. So it's a deep bottom, you're going to the bottom. You're just going to go out, you're going to go down a certain depth, and you're going to float along at that depth.
Oh, I see.
And I would assume either, I'm not sure what sharks they'll be, mostly, I would think, probably silky sharks. And I don't know if there's any oceanic white tips in right now. Beautiful shark. And but the silky sharks are also, they're just absolutely majestic and beautiful shark. I had the misunderstanding when I was younger that the silky shark was a little on the smaller side. And then when I went diving in Cuba, I learned that I was way wrong.
Maybe not.
They were big sharks. They were big sharks. And they, same way, they would swim in. They weren't paying attention to the divers. The Cubans, I don't know what they thought, if they thought it was funny, but we're sitting there shooting video, myself and that friend of mine, Bill Mills, from Florida Film and Video. And Bill, and we're sitting in there, and it's like, why are these sharks shooting in and getting so close to us, and they're bumping us and stuff? It's like, what the heck is going on? And then we kind of look up and we figure out they're throwing bait in on top of our heads. And it's like, don't do that.
They were just messing around?
Yeah, messing around with us. And the sharks are fine with us. They didn't bite us. But still, to have an eight-foot shark come in and to be, bumping you because they're going for the...
It could bump your gear off, too.
Well, the lighter color of my head is probably pretty close to the color of a fish fillet, mm-hmm. too. So, or the ribs of a fillet.
Jim mentioned that, you'd be fully in black, and that with the mermaid, they had to dye her hair black. And
right. Jim does that. That's his methodology, and I believe him. I go with his methodology. I've seen others that are doing the similar shark dives where girls are wearing bikinis and stuff and not covered in a different color. And there haven't been any incidents, but why push it? It makes sense that the sharks don't see, there's nothing natural that's black in the water that they want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of go with Jim's theory on that.
Don't they eat seals?
Not down here. I haven't seen a sea lion or a seal down here for a long time.
They don't go, oh, look, made it all the way to Florida.
Right. Yeah, no, there's the great whites. No, their primary diet, one of their, depends on where they are. They're regional to where there's something to eat, there's something to eat it. And so the sharks are fairly regional to their diet. That goes with anything. I mean, orcas are the same way. They have salmon eaters, they have sea lions, they have whale eaters, and so forth, as far as the orcas go. And the same thing with the sharks. If they're in an area where there's a large population of sea lions, that's their primary diet. The great white sharks off of California, they think that they're mostly fish eaters. But it depends on, again, it depends on what their area is or the region that they're in and what's the primary diet there. They kind of change.
It stops.
Oh, okay. Our helicopters are down here is a big problem. So because they're all the way up in Panama City, and the helicopters don't, we don't take them far.
We go that far.
We have three helicopters there with the business. We fly tourists up and down the beach. And my twin brother runs that. He retired out of the Navy Experimental Diving Unit, where they test all the equipment.
Interesting. So he was military. You were military.
Right.
And your sister's cows.
Right.
And what's the other brother?
My older brother is a helicopter mechanic. He works for a company called Petroleum Helicopters, PHI. He spent 15 years in Antarctica at McMurdo Station in support of the National Science Foundation. And now he's over in Saudi Arabia. They have contract. They're maintaining the helicopters for the Saudi Red Crescent. That's their air ambulance service in Saudi Arabia.
That is, like, so impressive to have four siblings mm-hmm. that are pretty much on the path of doing what it is that they seem to be passionate about and love doing. Yeah. So what do you feel your parents did to maybe influence those decisions, or did they just leave you alone and let you figure it out for yourself?
A little bit of both. They encouraged us. It's funny because I'm dating myself now. The era of Sea Hunt and the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau was what we grew up in. I mean, we were children watching this in the 60s. So we got very intrigued with the undersea world, you know, again, with Jacques Cousteau. But it was something that we were really interested in and enthralled with. And we got a Mass Norgon fins from a department store, which was in a larger city because we grew up in the country. The town was the largest town in the county seat, and it had only 2,000 people in it, one stoplight in the entire county. And my mom would go to jail for this today, but she would load us up at 9 years old, and she would take us about 8 miles upriver, and she would drop us off at Robbie Williams's farm.
Yeah.
And we would get in the river with our mast snorkels and fins, and we would swim all the way back down to town. And in the south, you know, this is to show you the regional, South Fork of the South Branch of the Potomac River. So it was a tributary to the Potomac and the mountains of the Appalachian Mountains in West Virginia.
How old was the youngest and how old was the oldest when you did that?
Well, the older brother didn't do that. It was just the twins, myself and my older brother.
Okay.
And so we were the ones, and we had friends that did it too, that would go with us as well. So there'd be kind of a group of us, three or four, I don't remember ever being five. But we would get in the water
awesome
and swim.
Mom.
Well, it was. And we were interested in caving back then. And, you know, when we got a little older, we were 14 years old, didn't have a driver's license. My mom would take us to one of the local caves that we researched and found out where it was. And she would drop us off along the roadside. And we would go up and go crawling around in the caves, spelunking for the day. And she set a time, and we would meet her out there. She was usually sitting there reading her Agatha Christie novel by the dome light of the old Bonneville Pontiac Bonneville. And there was one occasion we were 2 hours late of coming back from caving, and we were sitting there thinking we were in so much trouble. We get out there, and Mom's sitting there, and she looks at the clock in the car, and she says, "You're a little late, aren't you?" Because we thought for sure she was going to call the sheriff's office and, you know, search and rescue. So, like, no, not Mom. She knew we were okay. You know, we were those kids that we had our mother on Valium. That's when the Rolling Stones came out with Mother's Little Helper.
Oh, kids do that. You know. I have a 16-year-old son, trust me. I know all about it.
Yeah, the twins are, I think, a little bit different. And we were kind of hell on feet, and especially young. But none of us are dead. None of us are in jail, so I guess we're okay.
That's the trick.
So, yeah. And my parents are still alive, fortunately. They're still with us. 85 and soon to be 86, my dad. And having some health problems, but they're doing well. They still live on a little 20-acre farm in West Virginia. And beautiful place out in the country. And they'll never leave, as far as we can tell.
And how did your dad feel about your caving and snorkeling?
Dad was never... We had a different relationship when we were younger. We're kind of best of friends now. I deer hunt with him every year. We'll do a deer hunt together for as long as we possibly can. I've been doing that for the past 6 years now. And Dad didn't have a whole lot. With Dad, we hunted and fished, but the caving and the scuba diving and stuff like that, they kind of supported us. It was interesting the way they did it. We grew up in kind of a middle class family. You know, I look back on it, we didn't have a lot, but when it when we came time to learn to scuba dive, they really supported us. I mean, I think they thought of it, we're doing this, we're not getting into trouble. Okay, we're doing this, we're not getting into too much trouble. We still got into trouble, as in, teenagers are teenagers. And, we had our issues when we were growing up, but we all cleaned up our acts. And again, none of us had a criminal history. And
That's such a reassuring note to hear on all mothers out there that have rebellious teenagers on their hands.
You know, there's a certain point, this is a circle of life. All teenagers, I think, and this was my experience in law enforcement and dealing with juvenile delinquents, if you will, that a lot of them grow out of it. And those that don't, we have penitentiaries. So they... a lot of them will grow out of it, and they learn the errors of the ways. And I'll be honest with you, I got in trouble when I was a kid. A friend of mine and I, we broke into a van, a telephone company. Who cares about the telephone company? We figured they're always stealing from us anyway. Mm-hmm. But we got in trouble. We broke into a telephone company van and stole some stuff. We didn't damage anything. We managed to get in without busting a window or anything, thank goodness. That would change things, I think, the attitude. Well, we got caught. It took a couple of days. They figured out who did it. And I have to tell you, there was a police officer named Teddy Hoffman.
You still remember the name.
Oh, yeah.
He's a good guy.
Well, there's a sad part of the story. Is that he knew my parents, and he knew the guy who was the local manager of the phone company, and they knew my parents. And it wasn't really fair to those who got in trouble and stayed in trouble, but they worked things out. And Teddy... he was the single most reason why I became a police officer. And I say this, I always said that in my interviews. He was the single most reason why. And it really went a long ways to get me my jobs, I think, when I was working as a cop. But he really was. He was the single most reason. The way he handled us and my goal in life as a police officer was to return that favor to some kid and to do that sort of for Teddy. And the sad part is, and I kind of choke up when I think about it, I went back to visit Teddy, and I wanted to thank him for what he did for me, and he'd already passed away. And it would have meant a lot to me if I could have said something to him, could have thanked him. Because if some kid came up to me and said, hey, I got to thank you for what you did for me, I tell you, that would really make my day. It would make my week, my month, and mostly like my year, because I tried to return that favor to it when I was dealing with kids. And then you got the feeling, you got a feel for some kids that just wasn't,
They're all good. They're all good kids.
For the most part.
Their hormones are crazy. Yeah. They're trying to hang on to peer pressure. There's so much going on in their lives.
So much as their parents, too.
Yes.
I had one little kid that was a really sad case. We tried to take him under our wing. I brought him over to my parents' house. I had him shoveling horse manure and working in the stalls at the barn and doing stuff, and we would pay him and things. And I caught him doing something once, and I gave him a break, and then I caught him a second time, and I had to send him away. I didn't have a choice because he victimized the wrong people. And I couldn't do anything more for him. And it was a sad part because he came from a bad environment, alcoholic parents, and a very dysfunctional family. What do you say? It's difficult. And he was in a difficult situation, but a good kid, I think. And I don't know what ever happened to him. I really don't. I ended up moving from West Virginia to Colorado, and lost touch with him, and I don't know where he is. I would like to think that he worked things out. But he was a good little kid, up to a point. He just managed to steal from the wrong people, and I couldn't help him.
And it's funny, it seems like a lot of the time the kids that are the ones that fight the system are the ones that end up either continuing to get into trouble or are very, very successful. Because they think outside the box, and they don't necessarily go with the flow of what everybody else says.
Yeah, that's rebellion. There's that, and I think... And I agree with you. There's the environment that the children grow up in. Some of them just have stuff that is just so far against them. And the kid that pulls out of those environments, you hope that there's a mentor that can really turn things around for them. And if they don't have that, it's tough. They absolutely have to have some mentor, be it at the school or after school programs, if there are those. But I believe in individual responsibility, and And the other thing, and I hate to say this, but the parents said that, you know, the not my kid syndrome, you don't know what to do with them. You know, when I grew up, if I got in trouble, I didn't have to worry too much about my parents not supporting whoever said I didn't do anything. I had to worry a lot about it because they were, first off, it's, you know, they believe somebody else over me. Now, that's not a bad thing. It's just that somebody, you know, they trusted that somebody wouldn't come and falsely accuse us of doing something. So my dad was the enemy, you know, getting a little off topic, but my dad was the authoritarian, and if we got in trouble, we better tell him first. We better not hear it from somebody else. So we, and that was a tough one.
How to whip some honesty into you.
Well, you know, there was part of that, too. Different day and age now.
Yes.
So, but it wasn't really a, you know, well, it was kind of the household was a little bit of the spoiled rod, you know, or spoiled child, spare the rod, spoil the child. But
where did you grow up again?
In West Virginia.
Is that very religious?
To a certain extent. I mean, there's that's I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't say that's Bible Belt.
That's the word, it's a fairly, right. Bible Belt. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairly religious area. You know, fairly conservative. And interesting part of West Virginia. And again, we're sidetracking here, but I grew up not knowing what racism was. And people think of West Virginia, think of racist and or bigotry. There were some Jewish kids that went to school, and I thought of them no different than the guy who went to the Presbyterian church. You know, we didn't think of it any different. And we had some black kids that went to school with us, but we had a black teacher in both the grade school and the high school that were absolutely the finest teachers in the system. Without a doubt, they were absolutely the finest teachers, and I think that little bubble of Moorefield, West Virginia, raised a whole generation of people that just didn't know racism, and it was really an interesting place to go back to, and because again, we're sort of a little microcosm there. But back then, it was a long drive to go over the mountains just to go shopping. We didn't have a department store.
And certainly no social media.
Now it's different. But it's an interesting place, beautiful place to go to.
Do you go back?
Yeah.
Is that where your sister is with her farm?
My sister's up in Maryland. She's north of Frederick, and she has a 200-acre dairy farm, and she raises Jersey cattle, Jersey dairies. One Holstein usually on the farm. That's it. She hates Holsteins.
Holstein is another type of cow.
It's big black and white cow.
Why does she got them if she hates them?
I don't know why. It seems like I go there, there's always one Holstein. I think it's just a reminder how much she loves her Jersey. And the Jerseys are small cattle. They're very easy to handle. They have a very pleasant disposition. The Holsteins, I don't know. They just seem to be really big and stupid. And if they slip on the concrete, on the wet concrete, it's a chore. And I've sat and watched them, watch these cows sometime. And the little Jerseys are really pretty cool cattle. You go walking down through the field, and I deer hunt there, and I go walk down through the field to hunt the lower corner of the property, and they follow me like I'm a Pied Piper. It's really pretty remarkable. It's a lot of fun. So, but I know we got off topic there.
We're going to talk a little bit about the technology of how this whole mass works, right?
Right.
So go ahead. How does it work? It's between the sound and the defogging and the no water getting in when you call that.
Well, the mask itself is just a platform. It's for us to put the communications in. And our company is an underwater communications company. So that's where we came from. We're not a full face, well, we are now a full face mask company because we manufacture this. But how the communications work is, and what you'll be using is going to be an ultrasonic communications device. So basically it uses sonar. It's a through water communications device. This one is a buddy phone. Now, the buddy phone is a transceiver. It's everything that you need to communicate, except obviously you don't have your regulator in place. But it has a 9-volt battery that powers the system. The two screws are a water switch, which turns it on when you get in the water. This little knob here is the transducer, basically the antenna. On the backside here is the speaker. Now, the speaker goes over your ear, and that's how you hear. The cable comes down to a push-to-talk button, just like a walkie-talkie. It works half duplex, meaning the only one person can talk at a time. A telephone is full duplex where you can talk over each other and talk at the same time. With this, if you're talking, you're not listening. If you're listening, you're not talking. So it has to work that way. And you push the button and hold it. Now, the signal is a sonar signal, so it transmits from transceiver to transceiver or from transducer to transducer. And basically, like your fish finder on your boat, and this is a boat program, the depth sounder on your boat, your fish finder on your boat, has a transducer underneath. It sends out a signal, and it bounces off of whatever object you're looking for, be it fish or the bottom. And that return comes up to the transducer, and it's picked up and then it's interpreted into the image that you see on your screen. With this, a little kind of simpler, really, in a way, is that we just take the analog signal of your voice through the microphone that's on the inside, and we send that sonar signal out, carrying voice on the sonar signal. So it's just a wave, wavelength, a waveform that goes out in an analog, not digital. Digital's ones and O's. This is an analog signal. So if you could hear an ultrasound, you could hear this communication. So it transmits, again, we kind of depend on the incompressibility of water, and it transmits a fairly long way, so, through the transceiver, or through the water, from transceiver to transceiver. This puts out about a half a watt of energy, a little less than half a watt, and it's called the buddy phone, so it's for talking to your buddy. Relatively short range, but I've gotten as much as 1,000 yards out of it. We have another system that's a higher powered system. Yes, it'd be 2010. This puts out about 20 times the power of the buddy phone. It uses a little different system. It's got a cable. The cable goes to the mask that basically, if you picture a headset and a boom microphone, that's embedded into the mask. So you have your earphones. You have the push-to-talk button and a whip that plugs into the radio. And again, it has a transducer on it, water switches, the same feature in a much bigger and higher power package. And so what you're going to be using is you're going to be transmitting to the surface. I'm not sure exactly what the camera system is, that they're running a wire up to the surface, and they're tying in wireless. I'm pretty sure that's the way he's got it set up. What they're doing, we provide just the communications, and then what Jim does in his collaboration with, he's working with GoPro to send it out now up to the video and the audio up to the surface, and then it's transmitted, I'm assuming probably by 4G through your cellular service that it'll be transmitting using, I think you use Periscope.
Mm-hmm.
And
Periscope.
There's a few, LiveView, Livestream is another one, Periscope. You could even do a Skype call if you wanted to do a Skype call. And then now Facebook Live is another way. I think I envision in the future we'll have some people that are doing similar events on Facebook Live. So it's working pretty well. So that's the way it works. It's the wireless system. We have other systems that are hardwired where you run an actual umbilical to the surface. And so you're talking of copper. So you've got your earphones are wired to the surface, the microphone's wired to the surface, and you talk over that.
Why don't you do it that way as opposed to...
That's primarily for public safety divers that are on a tether, because you always know where your diver is in public safety diving at the end of the tether. And as long as you're running a tether to your diver when they're running search patterns and you're controlling those search patterns from the surface, as long as you're running a tether to them, you might as well be able to talk of it. And that's a primary industry for us. We sell literally... to around 200,000 feet of comm rope a year. I mean, you think about 200,000 feet, that's miles and miles and miles of comm rope. So that's what the hardwire is. You're primarily, again, public safety and military. But I think you're going to enjoy it. Again, crawl, walk, run. Learn, take your time, get your refresher done, not with a mask, just use your regular gear. Then take a second dive, if you can, in a pool or someplace shallow. And you give that a shot
with the
mask,
yeah.
And then you want to just become comfortable with it. They may put you at where you do a ditch and dawn. Well, a ditch where you take the mask off, you go to your alternate air source, and you take out your other mask.
I watched the video of you doing that. Is that you doing that?
Yeah, that was.
You made it look so easy, pretty nifty.
Yeah.
I mean, you just basically took it off. And you were ready to go.
Yeah, it's not difficult to do. It's one thing you want to prepare for is a failure of your system, and to be able to go to the backup, your backup system. Always have an alternate air source or a buddy nearby with an alternate air source, being the octopus of your regular. And you want to be able to bail out and terminate a dive safely. One thing that I would suggest is that, when you do your refresher, think of things that all your equipment never going in the water with anything that's not 100%. If it's not, BCD insulator or whatever, if it's broken, don't dive it. And train to a point as to where the failure of no single piece of equipment should be a fatal event. So keep that in mind. It's not a dangerous.
So from losing half of your flipper to.
I haven't seen the sharks take one. I haven't seen the sharks take a fin. They do take cameras. Ask Jim about them stealing his camera.
Really?
He's had a couple of cameras stolen and didn't come back. The shark came along, grabbed his camera, and off it went, and into the blue, and never found his camera. And we're talking expensive cameras, $10,000 setups.
So, I'll take that.
Yeah, and how you can't outswim a lumbering, slow swimming tiger shark.
And then you're gonna battle him for your camera.
No. Yeah, it is. There's YouTube. Search YouTube. There's YouTube videos of it.
Taking it. Oh, I will.
So, but no, you'll have a good time. Just take it easy, enjoy it, and it should be on your bucket list. Well, it's on your list now, so you don't need a bucket. I think you'll enjoy it. You'll have a great time. The sharks are not there to eat you most of the time. Keep in mind that if a shark does come up at you, you want to punch him in the nose. And if that doesn't work, you poke him in the eye with your stomach.